All right, y'all, it's spring, and you know what that means. It's time to start planning our summer festival traveling. Yep, it's time to get into my Airbnb bag cross-country, a.k.a. Time to visit my homes all across the country. And you know what I never think about? Why not list my own spot on Airbnb and host some folks at my house? I mean, my house is cute. Yes, let's make money while we're spending money. Just trying to help you out, man, because your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
I won! Yahoo! Private, put down your phone. This is the army.
Sarge, High Five Casino is a social casino. It's on your phone. Goes wherever you go. I win free spins, cash, prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. I won again!
Platoon, present cell phone. High five!
High five!
Casino!
Casino!
Win at HighFiveCasino.com!
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Questlove Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Questlove Supreme. I'm your host, Questlove, and with me, of course, is the ever-present Team Supreme, Fontiglet. What's up, man?
What's happening?
Yeah, I was about to say, you got to tell me, what's the after effect of the host little brother documentary for you?
It's been a lot, man. I think the first week it came out, like when we first put it out there during Black Friday, I had one of my homies hit me and was like, yo, man, I haven't talked to my sister in 3 years and I'm gonna give her a call after watching this. So it's been stuff like that. Like, it hasn't even been a lot of music shit. It's been people just been hitting me, just talking about
personal shit.
Like, yo, my man's like, yo, I'm about to start my own business now. I've been bullshitting this, you know. It's been a lot. So it's been opening up a lot of conversations that I think we're, it was kind of overwhelming at first, just to kind of be getting all that at one time. You know what I mean? But people really enjoy it, and they see the spirit of what we made, and, you know, the love and care what we made it. And so I'm just happy that people are enjoying it, man.
Yeah, I was going to say that we're kind of at the end of the stretch, like where we must turn a record in somewhere. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like, kind of after watching the documentary, I was like, hey, do we have to give this to a major label?
Like, listen, come on.
Can we?
Dude,
come on. Come on, so, somebody. Come on.
He preaches this forever.
I was going to say that we're seriously trying to, I think we're considering, you know, taking the training wheels off and see if we can do this for Delph.
I mean,
technically, yes, we owe Def Jam another record, but it's also like, it's been 10 years and there's a whole nother administration there. So, you know, it's not like, I think they're crying like, damn it, Roots, you know,
right.
Yeah. when we were last there working on How I Got Over, there was an executive in the studio with us and he was talking shit about us, thinking that Tariq was like one of the staff at Electric Lady Studios.
You didn't even realize.
Oh, man. I don't know what they look like. I don't know the album. I'm just fucking hearing shit, man. Tariq's like, yo, I'm in the studio with you. He was, oh, I'm sorry. I thought, oh, damn. I thought he worked here. So,
man, y'all don't need it at this point. Y'all an institution, man. I love to see it. That'd be dope.
Yeah. So I'll say that you definitely planted the seed in that to see if we can do this on our own. Bill, what's up, man?
Yeah.
How's it going?
All of our lives. Like, I'm great. I was just thinking about what I learned from the Little Brother documentary is do whatever the fuck you want. And be really good at it. Like, that's the best piece of advice. Like, don't succumb to anybody else's wants. Just do you and be true to your art. Like, no shit. And we all make art here, but like, to be that true to it and like honest about it is really cool. And that's what I learned, amongst other things, about mm-hmm. other certain people. That's what I learned from the Little Brother documentary.
That's what's up.
I loved it.
I would love to say that you're at like your JMI jazz recording offices, Steve, but
he's down the
that's how official it looks right now. So I don't know what's going on. Like, you got your own merch now, your own bags. Like,
oh, you saw that? Yeah, we're doing well. JMIRecordings.com. Sorry.
Yeah.
Little jazz label here in
Yo,
New
Steve,
York.
I wanted to tell you too, bro. I bought, I finally broke down and bought a turntable. And I've listened to like all like the records that you've given. Bro, they sound amazing, man. Like, they sound amazing. Like, they sound great on vinyl. So now y'all are doing a great job, bro. This shit is dope. The record sounds really great.
Thank you so much. I'll send you, I'll fill you in on what you don't have.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I cop. Send me the link. It take money.
He makes house calls. He came to Hoboken and delivered me records. That happens.
Damn.
You just have to ask. Wow. Nicely. I'll just show up.
Damn. Right. Meanwhile, Steve and I live in the same building. I find myself stealing my own product. Anyway, so let's get to it. I will say, I love a good transformation story. The artistic metamorphosis, or what we call departure albums. I've even taught about departure albums at NYU for a few semesters. For those not hip to the term, departure album is basically like the one album in your canon that doesn't sound like what you represented when you first came in the door. I mean, there's some legit metamorphosis, like artists like Prince grow eventually. I guess the most famous departure album would be
Riot Going On.
Well, no, I was going to say Sgt. Pepper's was the very first one, because the Beatles wanted to kill the Beatles, or the idea of the Mop Tops and Teeny Boppers and Never Tour Again. And then that backfired and actually made them more famous and then caused them to implode. But even that was inspired by a departure record, which I guess you could say Pet Sounds by the Beach Boys is that. But I mean, there's millions of them. There's
Secret Life of Plants.
Yeah, Secret Life of Plants, Riot Going On, Kid A, Graceland.
Ray of Light.
Yeah. Madonna. Oh, Ray of Light?
Uh-huh.
Actually, was she trend hopping, or was that really
legit? It was a departure from what came before. I'll say that.
Right, but, right. She wasn't pop. Okay, you're right. But I mean, well, Awaken My Love, 808s and Heartbreaks for hip hop. Paul's
Midnight
Boutique.
Midnight Vulture's back.
There you go.
Yeah.
Bitches Brew, Dirty Mind. So it's all there.
Did the Roots have a departure album? What, Phrenology or something?
It's hard to say. I mean, Phrenology wasn't more an excuse to do something different than I realized like how slow. I was listening to Roots Come Alive and like shit was like slow, but also doing the Roots Come Alive, like I was at my physical heaviest at like 400 plus pounds and I had lost weight for Phrenology, and then suddenly I felt like I wanted to be more energetic. So, and then it became like, let's just do what we're not supposed to do. So it's sort of a departure record, but time will tell if I was just, you know, not willing to face the keep the things fall apart thing alive. I don't know. But I will say that our guest today has been a longtime favorite of mine since her 2006 debut. And shortly thereafter, I was fortunate enough to, I guess, a year later, work with her on Al Green's Laid Down album. And then a year after that, we worked on her sophomore album, The Sea. And, you know, I kind of thought I had her completely figured out. And nothing prepared me for her fourth record. I'll just say that much. Quick backstory, I guess our guest and I reconnected in the summer of 2023. She gave me a copy of the record. She did it so casually that 2 days went by before I remembered that, oh, I have the record. Let me peep and see what's up. And I was kind of gobsmacked. And again, I'm trying to avoid typical Questlove hyperbole when it comes to my excitement for something. But, it's been a minute that I've listened to a complete album on repeat over again by an artist not named Salt. And I will just say that there's a lot to unpack here. Normally, I want to go through the whole, you know, journey of an artist's life, but I'm so obsessed with this record. I have so many questions. I might have to do this interview backwards. But yeah, for me, Black Rainbows is one of my favorite records of the year. And I'm really, really excited to have a conversation with our guest today, Corinne Belly Ray on Questlove Supreme. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks so much. Thanks for that introduction.
Wait, let me see. Oh God. Okay, 12 minutes. We're not bad. Normally, I don't even get to the guest until 27 minutes. All right, and it's time to go. Thank you very much, Corinne. Thank you. So right now you are in, you're in Connecticut right now, correct?
Right now I'm in New York. So I may or may not be getting up to Connecticut today. It depends. There's loads of snow on the road. So yeah. I always try and make a show. Like, I'm happy to be there. And if only 20 people come, then we're still going to have a good time. But we'll see what the venue says. I hate cancel shows. It's so disappointing. You know, I hate to be a fan and have the cancel show. And I've been to so many shows where nobody else could make it, you know, and then you feel like you're the lucky 100 people who brave the storm or whatever. So yeah, hopefully we'll be up there tonight.
And when someone cancels on you, okay, let me get out my feelings. Anyway. Yeah, I hate when artists cancel on people. Well, first of all, I'm curious, for this particular tour, how many musicians are you with? Because this album is so sprawling in terms of its, I mean, you literally cover every, damn near every genre of music. And, you know, my obsession with it was, how is she going to pull this off live? What is the makeup of the band that you're with on tour?
The lineup, there's just six of us in the band. So there is Melanie Charles, who's singing, and she's playing flute, and she's playing percussion. And I'm singing and playing guitar, electric guitar, and some percussion stuff. Erin Burnett is playing tenor saxophone. Kyle Bolden is playing electric guitar, who I absolutely love. I've wanted to work with him for a long time. He plays with Stevie Wonder. And we're lucky that Stevie's in the studio right now. So I just like entice Kyle. So he's kind of like three people. You know, he plays just one guitar. He showed me his guitar the other day. It folds in half and packs in a backpack. You know, like some guitarists really, it has to be this, and it has to be this wood that's maple and cherry and seasoned. And he's just like, it folds in half. He puts it in his backpack. He's playing one guitar through the whole show. The string, you know, it falls forward and the strings, everything. It's a portable guitar that he's playing right now. And he can cover, he's playing like wailing electric guitar. He's playing like really pretty. He's got Curtis Mayfield, and he just does it all. It's just in his fingers, you know, so he's amazing. Right. And then I'm playing with Stephen Brown, who's my longtime collaborator, and he has a massive setup. So he has a few keyboards. He's playing bass sometimes with organ pedals that he has underneath the keyboards. He's playing bass with his feet a lot of times, or sometimes he's playing synth bass. Sometimes he's playing electric bass, like on New York Transit Queen. He gets up from the keyboards, and he has a whole row on top of, we've taken spring tanks, and we've taken pedals, we've taken modular synths. So everything that he's doing on stage, sort of all of the sends from the stage are going into that rig, so that he can affect it in real time, so that he can, you know, if we're singing and we want it to get like trippy and transcendent, he can put in his delays and reverbs and backwards things and octavizers, and then that's going out to front of house. So yeah, we just put it all on a plane yesterday. I think our oversize or whatever, you know, when you have to pay overage, it was like $4,000 or something. Like, well, we can't leave any of this shit behind, you know, so it's just like boxes and boxes and stuff. But it's worth it, because I like to be able to make this more expansive sound.
Yeah, you know, I'm also known for completely wild outtakes, and of which I don't want to get canceled, so I'll save the majority of them behind. But I will say the safest one of my wild outtakes was, I think maybe this was ideally the album I thought I was making with Electric Circus, where you want to show a wide range of styles, but not appear to be too, you know, over eager or enthusiastic with it. Like, it just sounds natural. And then, you know, by the third listen, I realized that, like, you're covering so much territory. Like, you go from literally from this, you know, some shit goes completely hardcore to, you know, then you go Afrofuturist, then you do this 90s Riot Girls throwback thing. And then, like, with the last song, Before the Throne, like, it's almost like you transported back to an Alice Coltrane kind of outtake. And the thing was, like, I was hoping the song was going to be 17 minutes, like an Alice Coltrane song, and then it cuts off. And I'm like, what the fuck? But
that was one of my favorite ones on the album too. That's a hard ass. That's a hard way to close the album.
Yeah, it's goddamn. And it's can you tell me just from soup to nuts how you put it together? Because in my mind, it's so every song is so unique. I think if making it in real time, I wouldn't know how you would see it as cohesive. But yet together, it feels cohesive. Can you just describe to us the process of that?
I'm glad that it feels like one thing. And it felt like one thing to me because it was all driven by this obsession. And it was driven by this obsession with this building. I had been on a friend's board. It was like it was a Pinterest board that she had. She's called Jamala Johns. And she's kind of a art curator. I think in the early days of Pinterest, it wasn't just like, this is a cute hairstyle, but some people were using it like a magazine, you know, so they would put up a picture and then they would just write tons and tons. And she had this board called Artists and their Creatives and their Workplaces. So she had Kara Walker arranging her silhouettes. She had Picasso painting with light. And she had this photograph of this artist, this black artist, contemporary artist, this man, and he was sort of staring out of the frame with this peaceful sort of bold expression, and behind him was this weird contemporary art that I didn't understand, you know, a pile of bricks on the floor, this mm-hmm. shaggy goat instead of legs, it was had these spindles and it was going around on a circular track. And then there was a big shop for a big sign for a shop, Harold's Chicken Shop in Chicago, with like a chef chasing after a chicken with a meat cleaver. And he was familiar. Just looking out, like he was represented by a white cube, and he was looking out the frame like, yeah, this is my art, you know. And I right. thought, who is this? I don't know contemporary art. Who is this man specifically? Who is this black man who's not working in figurative art, right? It's not paintings of people. It's not drawings of people. It's not photographs. It's this stuff. And I found out that he was called Theaster Gates. And then when I did some research, I found out that part of his practice is saving these buildings on the south side of Chicago. You know, he lives in the south side of Chicago. He's watched many buildings just get torn down by the city, you know. Stony Island, where this building is, used to have big theaters, you know, really important theaters for black music. And just over the years, they've been torn down one by one. So, I mean, Chicago's architectural masterpieces. But then when you get to the south side, there's these holes, there's these gaps, and it's a kind of erasure of the history of the place and of the presence, the black presence in the place. And so he saw this bank, it's a 100-year-old bank, and it'd been slated for demolition for a long time. It's going to be pulled down by the city. The basement was underwater, but it's this beautiful bank with these columns outside, and it's like a big square sort of Greco-Roman building on Stony Island. And he decided he was going to save it. And so he bought it for $1 from the government, and he saved $4 million by selling his own art to transform this bank. So it doesn't have art in anymore. It doesn't have any money in. Mm-hmm. He's saved it by filling it with art archives and historical archives. So it has 26,000 books that were given to the Johnson Publishing Company, submitted to the Johnson Publishing Company, who made Ebony Magazine, Jet Magazine, the Negro Digest. Mm-hmm. So from 1943, you know, if you wrote a book in anything to do with black space, architecture, politics, dance, entertainment, recipe books, yearbooks, if you wrote PhDs and you wanted the Johnsons to review it and include it in their publication, you would send it to the Johnsons. So 26,000 of these books, you know, some of them we know and they're familiar, some of them super rare books. Mm-hmm. It's got those. It's got all of Frankie Knuckles' records in. So when Frankie Knuckles passed away, his entire record collection was given to the Stony Island Arts Bank. And it also has upstairs on the second floor these problematic objects from America's past. The mammy jars, the postcards depicting racial violence, newspaper articles since the 1800s, advertising copy, signage, objects for the home, ephemera, photographs that were collected by this black and Chinese banker called Ed Williams, who would go to these yard sales and flea markets and see these objects and think, you know, who's collecting these things? Who wants to continue to have these things in the home? So he would right. buy them to take them out of circulation and put them in boxes in his house. And once he had amassed 40,000 of these objects, his kids were like, "Dad, can we get, it's kind of intense to be around this stuff. Can we get this out of the house?" So he gave it, he donated it to the Rebuild Foundation. So the arts bank is contemporary art on the walls. It has exhibitions. Then it's these historic objects, the Frankie Knuckles. It's all the slides from the University of Chicago, the glass slides from when people give talks. So, you know, all of history that had been photographed for the University of Chicago. And then these 26,000 books. So when I saw the work that Theaster was doing, I thought, I want to get in that bank. I just want to be there. I just want to look around. I want to. And we managed to connect with him. I was on tour. He came to the show. He met up with me afterwards, and I was just like, I'm so excited to meet you, because you're a visual artist, because you also have a band called the Black Monks of Mississippi, because you're a ceramicist, which I love ceramics, because he trained in Japan, and because he's collecting these objects, and because he's saving all these buildings in the south side of Chicago. So he has a social practice. I was really excited to meet him. And I said, I really wish we'd come to the bank, but I'm leaving town at like 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. And he said, I'm also leaving town tomorrow because I'm going to President Obama's 50th birthday party. And I was like, oh, okay, this is who this guy is. So he opened the bank early for us, and I went to it. And once I opened those doors, I was just sort of blown away by the building, the size of the building, the library, the double height cube, the just the amount of stuff. You know, every single drawer you opened is like songs from slavery times, newspapers, curling newspapers from 1840s, print adverts from the 30s, tins of beauty products, you know, just stuff and stuff, and every corner and every, just the arrangement of it. And Theaster said, oh, you know, you have to do a show in here. And straight away I sort of flashed on the music that I had made to this point and felt like this is a new vessel. Nothing that I have made sort of fits in this space. It's a different kind of response that's needed. But then when I left, all I could think about was the things that I'd seen. You know, he had this sculpture in the corner, and I said, oh, who did that? And he said, it's one of mine. And it looked like it had been made from wood that had maybe had the paint stripped off. There was a certain amount of violence to it. And I said, oh, you know, what is it? And he said, it's a sculpture I made. It's from the floorboards from an abandoned police station in Chicago. And as soon as he said that, I immediately was thinking about the floorboards. What have the floorboards seen? You know, so often in history, the objects are the witnesses to what has happened. They're the things that can't speak, but they're the things that see everything. The floor in the police station, the telephone in the police station, the car, the rearview mirror, they're the things that really are holding the truth. And so when I was on tour, you know, I mean, my head was in the tour, but at the same time, I'd be lying in, on my tour bus bed, and I'd be just writing poems about things that I'd seen. You know, I wrote this poem called You Who Have Walked These Floors in Fear. I was thinking about this floorboard. It was after the death of Sandra Bland. So I was thinking about, you know, who knows truth? In some cases, it's a person. In some cases, that person is unwilling to express what has really happened in the situation, but all the physical objects they know. And I just thought, I want to get back to that bank. I want to open more drawers. I want to touch more stuff. And every time I touched something, I felt like it's old stuff, but it's fizzing with a kind of contemporary real life things happening in the molecules story. So really with the writing of the record, you know, I went back for a 2-week residency. We stayed in the south side of Chicago. I mean, I'm from the UK, but you guys know Chicago. Chicago has its huge challenges, you know.
Oh, we know.
Yeah. So that was an eye-opener. You know, we didn't have a car there. And we said, oh, we'll just, you know, we're staying so nearby, we'll just walk around. They're like, oh, no, you can't walk around. You can't walk around. You know, so we walked to the place where we hired the car. And on a bus shelter, there was an advert for what you could do if you needed to give up your child in the first 30 days of its life. You know, it was a list of things. It said, all you need to do is wrap it in a clean towel. It has to be in the first 30 days of its life. You could take it to a fire station, or you could drop it at this particular school or that particular hospital. You can give information, or you can have no questions asked. And it was particularly poignant that it was at a bush shelter, because of course that's where so many children that couldn't be looked after have been left by parents that couldn't look after their children. So,
right.
You know, just sort of walking, I thought, this is what this area is. And I thought about the importance of a building like this, which talks about the history of the area and talks about the history of the people and how the situation is as it is now, and it hasn't always been the way it is, and it won't always be the way it is, but how art is a place of, it's a new space, it's a physical space, it's a place where people have the opportunity to imagine something different. So I was there for 2 weeks. I wrote some songs there. I was home, I was back and forth. I mean, this record was sort of 7 years coming together, you know, so sometimes I was making music in the place. We set up a studio in one of the buildings next to the bank. And all the songs on the record are inspired by particular objects in the bank, or groups of objects or events in the bank. And that to me was my sort of golden thread when I was making it. And then to me, whatever the style was, it didn't matter. It just, whatever the music was, it just kind of bounced off the object. So it's all about the objects, and the tight remit was it has to be in response to these objects. And it just became my obsession. I felt like everywhere I looked, there was a story or a photo or something about Chicago, something about the South Side.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. NPR has a new collection of podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy and resilience, empowerment in creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Megan Thee Stallion to the Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Michelle Obama to the women behind the Montgomery bus boycott, there's no limit to the range of NPR. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now, they are the story. In NPR's Black Stories, Black Truths, you'll find a collection of some of NPR's best podcast episodes celebrating the Black experience. Hear a feed of episodes from across NPR's podcasts that center Black voices. It's NPR Noir. Turn on NPR today and hear a range of voices as varied, nuanced, and Black as the country they reflect. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segee, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
What comes to you first? Do the words come first or does the music come first? Because there's some songs in which he will follow me with his eyes, in which, like, specifically melodically, and your words are dependent on whatever chord's being played. And it's not a circular song that it's looping. It's just kind of going linear into and it morphs into a whole another song by the end of it. So
yeah,
like what comes first for you? Like, are the words hitting you first and then you find music to it, or does the music come first?
I think in that situation, in He Will Follow You With His Eyes, I had found this tin of a beauty product. It was by this company called Valmore, and it was set up in Chicago in 1926. And all the illustrations I found to be really beautiful, really elegant. And they were done by this artist, this black artist called Charles Dawson, who was a very, you know, well-known artist in his time. And they were elegant and they were beautiful. And there was also all this romance surrounding Valmore, you know, the copy of in the adverts. So yes, if you saw an advert for Valmore, it might say things like, his eyes will follow you across the room. Or the perfume. The perfumes were called things like, follow me, boy, or look me over. Everything had this romance and this glamour. So I was kind of interested. I was like, what's this beauty? You know, what's this company? And I found out that it was sold door to door. You know, so like Avon, they would knock on the door with this big basket of stuff. And I found out it was targeted mostly at black men and women. But of course, the era, I'm looking through the products, there's lots of perfumes, there's lots of moisturizers and shampoos and stuff. But there's a lot of hair straightening products, skin lightening products, you know, white rose, cold cream, and, you know, Ambi. Work straight away. The adverts would say Ambi. Things like, don't you want to help yourself to love and happiness? You know, all of this is just away from you if you don't just take, if you take your skin a few shades lighter.
That's why you're the rant at the end. Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say, because upon first listening, I was like, wow, this might be her best vocal performance. And then the second time I was like, oh, maybe she's singing in a character. And then I realized by the end, I mean, I don't know if it's more of an angry rant or more just a defiant thing about it, but I realized that must be the story. I didn't know the history behind the song, but I love the way that you sing in character in the beginning. And
yeah, I wanted to get into that sort of 50s space, and I was thinking about 50s medicated domestic femininity in America. Okay, so it's like you've got all the things you meant to need. You've got your vacuum cleaner and you've got your washing machine, you've got your refrigerator. So as a woman, your life is not difficult anymore. You know, you've got these appliances and you shouldn't complain, and you're in the home. And if things feel difficult, there's always a tablet you can take from the doctors just to take the edge off things. But then, you know, imagining someone coming to your door with these products, there's a kind of femininity is already this narrow. And then for black women, it's even more narrow because the beauty is white aligned at this point, you know, so you've got to do all the women's stuff, and then you've got to do the stuff to make your natural self augmented to be accepted. And so in the first half of the song, the person is definitely under the spell of Valmore. I wrote that song in the bank, and I played it on guitar. You know, I sort of do my best on my guitar. Like, I'm not a trained guitarist, but I wanted to make it sort of, you know, 50s and dreamlike, like those kind of chords that would be in, you know, those movies that start where the car's winding round the side of a mountain or whatever, the open top car, and it's like there's a glamour. And then halfway through, I wanted to have this kind of sonic arresting, you know. So when I first wrote that, that was just like me playing one string, dump, 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 you know, my plum red lipstick, my black hair kinking, my black skin gleaming. You know, I wanted it to be, as you say, sort of defiant. You know, it says at the end, I don't want to leave myself behind, vanishing into a girl I don't recognize. Because the record took me a long time. So one time I was listening to vocals, I was like, I feel like I could bring more character into this. You know, I was thinking of like a Eartha Kitt, you know, with her incredible diction and poise and the movement of the words and everything so dramatic and elegant and controlled. And I wanted to bring some in.
So in my excitement, I was making a quiet sleep playlist the day that the album came out. And so, not even thinking about it, I just rushed that on the list. The person went to sleep.
Then you wake up.
It was like, what the hell, Amir? And I was like, huh? And I was like, oh, I forgot that sometimes codas, and because, you know, in my mind, when you're listening to it, I'm thinking like, okay, might have a new ID track and that's the next song. I didn't realize it was the same song until that person told me, like, dog, you woke us up in the middle of the night. Like,
yeah,
it wasn't
what you thought. Yeah, it's the worst record for DJs, but I always think my stuff's a bit like that anyway, sort of like it's bumpy, like you're just getting into one thing and then there's another thing. And I don't know, that's my background. It's like I was a classically trained violinist, and then I was in an indie band when I was 15. That was a music that I loved, you know. I had grown up with soul music, but indie was like my thing that I found, you know, Veruca Salt and L7 and Belly. And I guess I liked, you know, women in that music. I liked seeing women play guitars, and I don't know, they weren't shaving their armpits or they weren't having to wear a certain thing. They're just wearing t-shirts and a jeans and they're just right. Doing the thing. And there was a lot of freedom in that.
Of course, I understand that a lot of your albums are also confessional diaries because of lost love and what you've gone through in mourning and all that stuff. But would you say that this album is more closer to your creative heart than, say, what your debut record was?
Yes, I think this is really close to my creative heart. And the irony is that I thought it was always a side project. You know, when I made it, I was like, it's not going to be my name's not going to be on it. It's an independent record. It's not going to be a major label.
So you're trying to fool Mariah, weren't you? I get it. No, Mariah sort of, do you know the history of the Chick record?
No, I mean, and not until you mentioned it the other day, but I haven't heard that record. You sent me some pictures and I thought, wow, she looks different. But yeah, I think she's amazing.
Yeah, Mariah did the same thing. Yeah. Like, she was just recording her real record, but just to have some fun, she would, you know, play around, fuck around, doing dinner breaks and all that stuff. And then they had enough material to make a record. But it was always just supposed to be like a joke amongst the bandmates, and, you know, and I still maintain that that's Mariah Carey's best record, because she doesn't care about the outward gaze of critics and the record label and keeping the machinery going. Because, all you know, all the time, artists tell me, like, especially like in the first 10 years of my career, it was like, man, y'all got a label that supports y'all. Like, and at first I was like a little insulted. He's like, yeah, man, because y'all could just do any old shit and your label will never drop y'all. Like, I was like, what is that supposed to mean?
Yeah.
He's like, well, you know, like y'all don't care about hit singles and making money and being successful. Yeah. I'm like, motherfucker.
No one needs that.
I was like, yeah. No, I just don't know what an effective hook is. I feel like I'm doing too much inside baseball, but you got to let me know. What was your inspiration behind Earthlings? Because I'm obsessive with Afrofuturism and all that stuff. And like,
I am too. You know, I feel my dad had funk, you know, like P-Funk records when I was little, and Parliament records. And I'd look on the back and see these weird cartoons, mm-hmm. you know, of like the women in the booby tops and the booty shorts and this. Yeah. And there was all this stuff about space. And I remember just thinking, like, what is this? And definitely when I was a teenager, I sort of thought of it as kind of a bit silly or escapist. And it was only when I got into my, probably, you know, 10, 15 years ago that the penny dropped, you know, and the expansive thing of, if someone wants to pigeonhole as being from here, you have to be within the system of what it means to be Black in America. And like Sun Ra, the only way to explain it is to say, actually, I'm not from here. Oh, you think I'm from here? Oh, you think I'm like that? No, I'm not even from this planet, you know? Mm-hmm. And I loved that when I went back to that music, the idea that there's another space, an alternative space that lives outside of capitalism and white supremacy, and that this band is from there and they're going to take you there, and all you have to do is get on board the mothership. And so the philosophy of it, which I had missed in, because I was too busy just sort of enjoying the groove of the music, you know, mm-hmm. that was right there. And so, I mean, there's a really good Afrofuturistic film showing in the bank when I was there. And, you know, I was thinking, tying all these things together. But the main thing was the inspiration behind that was these different searches for utopia that I read about in the bank. You know, there was a conversation bouncing backwards and forwards between the Black thinkers from, I guess, the, you know, 1810s onwards. The classic two positions, you could call it a Martin Luther King versus early Malcolm X, you know, integrationist versus separatist position. You know, we find ourselves to be here outside of Africa in this country, in these places which are intolerant of us. What do we do? Do we find allies and make a new community? Do we become part of everyone? Are we all each other's brothers and sisters, like a Martin Luther King position? Or is there, do we recognize the aggression and turn inwards and turn away from the place where we find ourselves to be? And whether it's a Marcus Garvey going back to Africa, or whether it's a more of a spiritual separatist community where you're still in America, but you have your own commune and you have your own rules and laws, and or whether it's a community of that's exclusive in terms of who you socialize with. You know, so I would see these ideas going back and forth in the bank all the way through history, people trying to work it out. How do we live now outside of Africa in this place which is not entirely welcoming? And so I've thought a lot about these utopias that have been attempted, you know, the all black towns of the West, and those of them that were successful and those that weren't successful, or were like a Greenwood that was eventually firebombed, you know, the first incidents of firebombing on American soil. So I thought about those, like, what is it to yearn for utopia? Try for perfection. It always will fail. And yet that's the direction. That's what all communities are looking for. Peace, love, freedom. You know, I was blown away by Mrs. Johnson using the Ebony Fashion Fair, and the Black Panthers would say to her, why are you bringing up clothes? You know, this is a bourgeois thing. You're bringing clothes from France to put on the back of black models to parade around the town halls and the city halls for local black maids to see. Like, what are you doing? And she, apart from the fact they were raising millions of dollars for the historical black universities and colleges, Mrs. Johnson was saying it's important for people to see themselves reflected on this catwalk. It's important for women to see this elegance, see this dream, see this art, see this creativity. It's like, what do we want on the other side of the struggle? Struggle's meant to end at some point. And then you're meant to be, you know, eating pineapple in the sun, digging your garden to live, and finding work, but also time to enjoy yourself. You know, that's the world we're trying to build. We're not constantly so much in a struggle that we're imagining it will never end. And so I guess the song Earthlings is about a non-human person sort of looking in on us and seeing how easy it would be to reset our world, which of course is a super naive position. But that was the position that I took from looking at these attempts at utopia, sort of the effort, the attempt, the hope, the audacity of it is the only place to start.
Well, I'm curious to how the outside of America, like the British press, has received this record. And, you know, I think it's really curious that you, and interesting that you chose Chicago as your
base,
creative hub. You know, I think if anything, even Americans, and myself, I might be guilty of this as well, it's like there's so much propaganda talk about Chicago. Like right now, you know, the hashtag "What about Chicago" is a kind of go-to right wing, term of, you know, they're so violent and uncultured over there that most people I know are definitely afraid to even visit Chicago just because of what they heard, you know, propaganda wise. But is there not any place in the UK that has their own rich cultural stories that you could have pulled from? Because I find it very interesting that you had to come, you know, 5,000 miles across the pond, you know, to find this wealth of inspiration.
I think it's a really good point. I think the holders of archive is a really interesting thing in America versus the UK. So I'd say American history and archive seems to be, I mean, you have obviously the Smithsonian, which is a reasonably new museum that holds all this black history and archive. But it seems like a lot of black archive in this country is held by private individuals or private foundations that have come from corporations. Like America's still in its move of, you know, you've got the Mellon Foundation, you've got the Ford Foundation, organizations that made lots of wealth through capitalism that are now sort of giving back, and it shows their brains and it sort of legitimizes them to a certain extent, and it shows that they are invested in people's history and holding history. I think in the UK, that period certainly happened during the Industrial Revolution, where we had massively wealthy industrialists in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, and they then invested in people, in art. You know, they made their own towns, they had fair, comparatively fair places and safe places for workers. But then the state took over in looking after history and archive, which is probably the right place for these things if the state is interested. But at the moment, the conservative government that we have now, which is more of a right-wing government, there just hasn't been the investment in Black stories and Black archive. So there are Black archives that aren't open to the public and that you would need maybe a research, a qualification or sort of invitation to go and look at. But also so much of the work is not valued or lost, or it's lost. I mean, I think specifically of the Windrush incident that happened a few years ago, where people like my dad's generation, the Black people in England are either from Africa and have come in the last 10, 20, 30, 40 years, or mm-hmm. they're Caribbeans and they were invited by the government after the Second World War because so many men had died. So the UK needed people on the trains, people on the buses. They needed women in the hospitals as nurses. So an invitation went out to the colonies. You know, they're still owned by Britain, like St. Kitts, where my dad's from. You know, please come and help the motherland. And these people felt like England was their home. You know, my dad knew more about the counties and rivers of England, you know, than he even knew about St. Kitts. It was taught, this information was taught in tandem. So all the Caribbeans came, and a lot of them came as children, you know, they had their passport. And you would think the government's held records on who was in the country and who wasn't. But a few years ago, there was this big scandal where Caribbeans were leaving their country that they'd lived in for 50 years, 60 years, moved for a family wedding, trying to get back in the country. And the UK said, sorry, we don't have any record of you.
Wow.
And it turned out they just lost all these people's passports. People had come to UK as children. So you've got people who are trying to get cancer care and they say, oh, you're not registered to live here. They say, I've lived here for 50 years. I've been married here. I've raised my children. I've got grandchildren in the UK. They say, sorry, you have to go back to Jamaica. So I think the UK government is not good at holding even the citizenship and passports of these Black people that they just lost. There was just no other explanation. It was just like, sorry, we lost your passports. But I don't think there was even a wide public apology. So I think in terms of the Black stories, I think they live in literature. You know, I live in Leeds with People Tree Press. That's the biggest publisher of Caribbean literature outside of the Caribbean. So I know these Caribbean stories. I think what I felt in encountering the bank was just, this is me with my own lens and my own prejudices as a woman from the UK, as someone who has African heritage through my dad's Caribbean side, but also, you know, my mum is white as well. Like all these, I was just arriving as myself, mm-hmm. viewing all this historical stuff. So the record is definitely not me trying to tell an American story. It's just me responding to all this stuff. Like, this is what the stuff did to me. That's what the record is, rather than I'm now some kind of, you know, historian or journalist on the American story.
Oh, no. Look, just to hear an artist with a point of view is fucking refreshing.
Refreshing.
Because what we dealing with now, like, what the fuck?
Man, well, I want to ask you, you've collaborated with, been frequently collaborated with very good friends of mine, Paris and Amber Strother. What is it like collaborating with them? How do y'all start sending ideas? What is it like?
I got introduced to Paris and Amber through Esperanza Spalding. I was working on my third record. And, you know, speaking of record companies, my third record was the one with all the pressure on. I was like, first record, big success. Right. So grateful. My second album was a kind of response to that. You know, everybody was saying, oh, you used to be in an indie band, but you've made this pop soul record. And I thought, right, I'm going to play more guitar on this record. But also, you know, halfway through that record, I lost my husband. And so there was this big break. And when I started again, I made the record that, you know, the label would say, you've made the record you needed to make. But it wasn't full of, you know, smash hit sunshine songs.
Yeah.
And so the third record, I really felt from the label was like, okay, right, let's get back in it. You're just a sort of sleeping giant, you know, like you've got this, you've had this big hits, these, and this is the record where you're going to sort of come back. And so that was really, really difficult for me. And I was working one time in Los Angeles with a very, very well-known producer and artist who, of course, I won't name. And he was very busy. He was working with several artists at the same time, which sometimes people do, right? So it's like, oh, hi, thanks for coming. Right, let's work on this song for 40 minutes. And then like, yeah, if you got some ideas, you call like Jerome. Jerome's my assistant, right? He's going to be in the room with you. I'm going down the hall because, you know, five other people are in the studio complex and I'm just like sprinkling my sort of genius hit power everywhere. So
sounds
I don't
like
know.
A mirror.
I wish I had that ability to sort of perform under that kind of setup, but I just don't. So it's like the inspiration just kind of left me. And I left the session and I can't remember how I saw Esperanza, but we met up and I was like, she's like, how's it going with superstar blah, blah, producer blah. That everyone else has had massive hits with? And I said, oh, it's going terribly, you know, it makes you feel like you're the one that's kind of flunking, you know, they're the superstar and you're the one. And she just said, have you met these guys? And she brought out the CD of the EP, King's
EP. King, yes sir.
And I was like, oh, I said, someone just played me this 2 days ago. It's so amazing. She said, I love them, I went to school with them, you should work with them. She picks up the phone. You should work with them tonight. I'm calling them right now. You should go. We'll go around tonight. And she picked up the phone. She's like, hey, Paris, you know, I'm with Corinne. I was like, I don't know if they ever heard of me. And they knew me. And we went over to the house and I just instantly loved them because aside from being the musical geniuses that they are, they just have this like still, well, you know them. Like,
oh, yeah.
Calm, beautiful presence. And we just sat and we just had a jam. Esperanza was playing bass, Paris was playing keyboards, me and Amber were singing. And I just thought, oh, I've sort of found a harbor here. You know, this is so different to being in the room with all these dudes, you know, like I've been told they're a songwriter, but they're just tapping out the beats. Like, where's your tune? Like, tell me when your track's finished so I can put my superstar beats to it. And I'd be like, we're just starting from scratch. I thought, you know, I kind of naive going into those settings. So it was just a dream to work with them. I worked together with them on my third record. And then, yeah, for this one, I would just drift in. So Red Horse came about at their place. You know, Paris is just amazing producer, you know, what she hears and the lines and the weaves and the denseness of the production, you know, the amount of tracks and all the things that's going on and one thing feeding another and all the lines. And so it's just kind of like a dream space. And we just got this beat going and Pras was playing chords, I was playing bass, synth bass. I remember I had my little baby. I just had a baby and she was strapped onto me and it was like playing. So it felt really kind of like it was working, you know. It's like, here I am, and my kid's asleep, and I'm doing this song. And then, yeah, the Red Horse came out of that, where because I had read so much of the bank and so much was in my head, I found it really easy to, what came out was the tales of the things that I'd read about, or I'd seen a photograph, like I'd seen this photograph of this young black girl who was going west with a white family. And couldn't work out what she was doing. She was 10, 11, 12. And it turned out, I mean, she was an enslaved girl, but she was going to be the nanny for this baby. And I sort of thinking, you know, who's looking after this child, this black child in the, you know, going to this West town in the West that's been newly established, and what's going to happen to her when they don't need her anymore? And, you know, I couldn't find any more information in this book. And so I just imagined for her a stranger riding into town on a red horse. But it sort of came out when I was there because they just make this amazing dream space. So yeah, I mean, I love working with Paris.
I was really happy to see y'all collaborate.
All right, y'all, you know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you gotta change your mind state. make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at Airbnb.com/host.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip-syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segee, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
I want to know more about your childhood and your upbringing. Where were you born?
I was born in Leeds, and that's where I still live. So Leeds is 200 miles north of London, and okay. It's 200 miles south of Edinburgh. Like, at the bottom of our street where we live, there's an old way post, and it says, you know, London this way, 200 miles, you know, Edinburgh this way.
So you're right on the border?
We're right between, yeah, the capital of Scotland and the capital of England. So as much as I feel, you know, I feel myself to, you know, be English, but the north is really different to the south. It's not as wealthy. It's more, it was industrial, but then the industry sort of went away. So there's that kind of a feeling. I mean, Leeds is a big university town, you know, Scots, I think more than 100,000 students between the different universities. So it's a big place where people come to learn. Lots of thinkers come, but then lots of people leave at the end of it, right? Because they go to London, they go somewhere else where the jobs are. So it's a creative place, but sometimes it's hard to get things going because there's not necessarily, people don't necessarily come and stay. They kind of pass through.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have three siblings, correct?
Or... Yeah, there are three of us. Yeah, there's two sisters. So my middle sister works in politics and she works in social justice. And then my younger sister acts. And then, okay. Yeah, then there's me too.
So what, can you describe the household? Like how... Were your parents artistically inclined or musically inclined or anything?
I think my mum really liked singing. My mum used to sing around the house all the time. So she would sing at church. And then my dad collected music. So that was his thing. He had just sort of piles of records. He was really fastidious. There was a really good record shop in Leeds called Jumbo Records that would import US records. So my parents would go there all the time. They met on the dance floor, you know, when they were teenagers. And my dad's family is from St. Kitts and the Caribbean. But yeah, he's a big collector of music. And so I think sometimes I would just look through these 45s, you know, they were just in paper. They didn't have any covers. So you could just maybe get a bit of an idea from the name on the label. But mostly you had to actually put the record on, you know, and just like put the needle on. And so he had his pile, and then I had my pile out of his pile of things that I liked to listen to that I kind of kept separately so I'd know what it was. And, you know, I grew up with music, definitely. But then I got into music at school, but neither of my parents played instruments. I started playing violin at school, and I really, really loved that. And at first I found it easy. I mean, later on I found it really hard because I do find reading music really hard, but I liked the thing of listening and picking up stuff. I really liked being in orchestras. You know, I was often the only person of color in the whole orchestra that was, or at ballet or whatever it was. But I think our parents, and especially my mum, just encourage us to express ourselves things. So we did, you know, we did do ballet, we did play instruments, we did go to watch concerts and went to theatre when we could. I mean, my mum was cleaning houses when I was younger, and then she started working with kids from school, from the school that I was at, you know, reading to them and the lessons, the kids who were struggling. Then she did some qualifications so that she could be a learning mentor in the school. And my dad kind of, first he had a shop, kind of picture framing and candles and clocks shop. But he was always, you know, he's got a big maths brain, which is the opposite of my brain. So he would teach, there was a school for kids who didn't get on well at school, and it was mostly Black and Asian children in England. That's like Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, mm-hmm. And Black children. And that was in the sort of concentration of Black area, Chapel Town, where his family came. So he would teach these kids, you know, he'd teach them maths. Mostly maths, a bit of English, but so all the boys and girls in our school that were maybe had a reputation of being more sort of tough, or like they didn't get on with Luggish. The teachers. they didn't get on with the teachers at our school. They would know me because my dad would teach them maths, you know, and they'd be like, "Mr. Bailey, so strict," and yeah. So it was. I liked growing up there. It had a big Caribbean community, Leeds. I mean, it still does. So I would be, I guess I grew up between these two worlds. Where we lived was a white area and a big Jewish area as well. My high school was a big Jewish high school. Lots of the Jewish teachers and children. So when it was Jewish holidays, like a third of the kids wouldn't be there. So our calendar was kind of worked around the Jewish holidays. And then my grandparents lived in the Caribbean area of Leeds. So I would always be like between these two worlds. Do I fit in these worlds? I do fit in them, but I feel different, you know, in both places. I feel a bit of different, you know. It's like I'm Black, but I'm sort of not Black in the same way my cousins are. Mm-hmm. And then I'm definitely not white, but I am my mum's daughter, you know. So it's always just like finding identity. And I think that's what I'm really pulled towards. I don't know, indie sort of, you know, Riot Girl, like all of that stuff, you know, feeling like I feel like an outsider. I have something to say. I am underweight. I'm riding to school on a bike, balancing my violin. I'm a nerd, but I'm also not from a wealthy background. So I'm fitting in, you know, like a lot of my peers might not be going to play in the orchestra or reading Jane Austen and, you know, Charlotte Bronte. But at the same time, that's just what I'm doing. So, yeah, I felt like an outsider, I guess.
Were you born in the early 80s, I believe?
I was born in 1979.
Okay. Yeah. So who did you gravitate towards musically? Like, who was the first, bing, like, moment of?
I mean, I guess Michael Jackson was the biggest thing in our world. Just that's the age that I am.
Yeah, you couldn't avoid him. Okay.
Yeah, couldn't avoid him. And so I remember there was a concert in Leeds. We used to live near this park called Roundhay Park, and it was a big park that used to have concerts. So like Madonna played there, or, you know, but Michael Jackson played there. And I remember it was like a sort of pilgrimage to go to this concert. Like, we couldn't afford tickets for the concert, but I remember it was a bank holiday in August that we went to the concert.
Oh, the Bear Tour.
Yeah, I mean, Michael Jackson's stuff was so interesting because obviously there was the music itself, then there was all the mystery around the man. But remember how they used to film the concerts is, I feel like nearly half of the concert wasn't showing him, it was showing the audience.
The audience going crazy,
So it was just showing these people having these responses to him. And I remember feeling that they had this kind of like melting sort of spiritual feeling. I mean, I think the music has what that music is doing in sort of jazz and harmony, because I'm not trained, I just don't understand what it's doing, but it still does the same thing to my brain where it's like, I don't know what's happening here, and this thing is transitioning into this thing, and there's this lushness, and then there's this tension, and then it goes away. And so his music had that complex sort of beauty, but it was being absorbed by all of us, including, you know, 5-year-olds, 10-year-olds. And so I think, I mean, aside from, of course, all the separate things about Michael Jackson, which we learned about in that time when those issues weren't swirling, I just Michael Jackson's music was kind of the pinnacle. But I grew up with Stevie Wonder as well because it's what my parents liked. I really liked Secret Life of Plants. That was the record I remember having. I remember touching the braille. I remember the sort of weirdness and mystery of it and the way the synth sounded and the photograph of him inside and the way you could see, you know, you could see his eyes. And so I sort of loved Stevie. I thought, oh, like I just felt in my heart, like I want to meet Stevie. I'm sure that all kids feel that, right? So, but then when I did get to meet him, I was like, this is like my dream that I had. And here I, you know, I wrote Stevie Wonder a letter and as a teenager saying about how much I love I never dreamed you'd leave. I'm trying to get, I never dreamed you'd leave in summer. I remember writing this passionate letter about it. And then I thought, why am I writing my letter? I should be writing it in Braille. And, you know, I never got around to sending it.
I was about to say, he learned Braille just to.
Yeah. He is a, you know, he reads Braille.
There's a funny story where, you know, producer Narda Michael Walden, he produced Whitney Houston's Want to Dance with Somebody, and he also did like Starships, like Nothing's Going to Stop Us Now, not like he was like Clive Davis's go-to guy. But he tells the story that he was so inspired after seeing Stevie do Fingertips when he was a kid. Somewhere in the mid 60s was a kind of a solar eclipse in which, you know, they warned parents, do not let your child look in the sun or else you're going to go blind. And, you know, they were giving out free glasses and you're supposed to wear glasses all day and whatever. And Narda was like, if I take these glasses off, then I too can be a genius like Stevie Wonder.
And, you'd just be blind.
He told me about the first time he got in trouble with his mom. Like, she said, this boy, and like, you know, like, punished him. But yeah, he wanted to be blind like Stevie Wonder so that he could be a genius. Do you remember the first concert that you went to?
The first concert I went to. I mean, I think I didn't go to concerts when I was little because, like I say, my parents got divorced. So, you know, we didn't have a car. We didn't have a telephone. We didn't. Mm-hmm. My mum was cleaned houses and then she worked at the school. So we didn't have spare money at all. Mm-hmm. You know, we used to get our clothes in a bin liner. From, unless it was Christmas or birthdays, but we used to get our clothes from people from church, you know, with their names still sewn in, you know, and so
right.
I'd be like, yeah, I love this. And just like, if they had Mary. Trainers, we always had the trainers, the Knicks, not the Nikes and all of that sort of stuff, you know.
Right.
But so we didn't go to gigs when we were little, but I remember I probably went to something like, I probably will have gone to the Cockpit, which was a sort of indie venue, and I would have gone to see a band, like some small bands like Shed Seven or the Charlatans, a band called the Charlatans that I really like.
I've heard of the Charlatans. Yeah, you mean you saw them in their early stages?
Yeah, I saw them. I mean, I think they're still they've been going a little while, but obviously now they're still going ahead. But yeah, I remember seeing a band called Kinnicky, which had a female lead singer, and I remember seeing Belly, who I thought were amazing. And so, yeah, just before I'd gone to gigs, I was doing gigs, you know, it's just a thing because it was the 90s and everybody I knew was in a band. And I was part of this church group and we had a youth leader who was called Simon Hall and he was really into music. He was kind of like a music snob, you know. So one time I turn up at church and he's like, here's a guitar. And I was just you know, couldn't believe it. And so I had to pay him back like £10 every month, you know, like I'd say, I've got my £7. He'd be like, oh, thank you. And, you know, sometimes he'd just say, oh, just buy me a pizza, you know, because he and but I managed to pay him back and he is, you know, still a dear friend of mine. But that was really great. And I used to play my guitar through the stereo because I didn't have an amp. But I loved learning songs. I sort of would learn songs wrong. I liked Lena Fiedby. I liked Bjork, you know, so I'd try and learn a Bjork song, but it not quite get the chords right. But then I had some chords I liked and then I could write a different song over. And I liked that time of music for, especially for women, it was really confessional. I loved Juliana Hatfield, and she had this song called My Sister. The song was like, I hate my sister. She's such a bitch. She acts like she doesn't even know that I exist, but I'd give her anything to let her know I care. But I'm only talking to myself because she's not there. And I remember thinking, you can write a song about that. You can write a song about how you feel about your siblings. You can write a song about your walk to school. You can write a song about how a boy laughed at your hair. Like, you know, so it's just, it was different to pop music, which was more like universal, everyone's included, you know, big messages. And this was just the everyday. And that was my entry into songwriting, because I thought, oh, you can write about anything.
Hey, are you aware of Nandi Bushell? So she's a kid from the UK. She is notable when she was like six or seven years old playing the drums on Instagram. Since then, she's caught the attention.
I think I've seen her play. I think one time we were supporting Lenny Kravitz and she came on the sound check and she played. I didn't know she was from the UK and I didn't remember her name, but I've seen her. She's played with Dave Grohl, right?
And Dave Grohl and Lenny Kravitz.
Yes.
Yeah, it's scary for her now. So she's entering her teens now and already, like, you know, first it was just the drums and singing, but then now she's like on her saxophone kick. Like, she plays saxophone now and keyboards. Like, it's the way that she's developing. Like, it's really interesting to see, like, who kind of rises to the occasion. Like, when they start off as, I'm not saying novelty, but like, when you're 6 and 7, like, your parents are sort of like being backstage parents and that sort of thing. And I was kind of wondering, like, okay, will she keep at it, you know, at 9, 10, and 11, now that she's getting up there? Like, she's, her chops are, like, she's not relying on the novelty of, like, hey, you know, cute black girl from the UK and I can play drums a little. Like, she's really kicking ass and getting more into songwriting and that sort of thing at such a rapid pace that, you know, it's mind blowing to me. I just wanted to know if you were aware of her. How did you start the band, and were you guys at all, like, seriously trying to pursue a record deal, or was it just like, hey, we're a local band?
We really were trying to get somewhere. I think I was very serious when I was a kid, and also the band that I'd seen, Kinnicky, they were only teenagers when they got signed. Like, they got signed out of high school. So I just kind of thought, like, it is possible, you know, it's possible for it to happen. And so my band was my best friend, who was called Jennifer Pugh. And me and her used to play violins together. So we used to make these tapes together of, like, I don't know, she's singing or I'm singing. We made up a story with, like, a keyboard thing about, made a song about monsters, you know, like when you're 10 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And then that just kind of kept going. And so when I started guitar, she started guitar, she got really good. And she was the lead guitarist, you know, she had proper mm-hmm. lessons. And then we had a friend who was just a badass. And she is called Joanne Wilson. She played bass, and she'd learned a bit of flute. She'd learned a bit of piano. She didn't really know the bass. So we used to have to teach her it, like, you know, 2 2 2 2 2 2 3 3 3 3 3 3 1 1 1, you know. But she's just right. Picked it up, and she just looked the part. And it was those days, you know, we can smoke indoors, and, like, so she would just, like, have a cigarette, and she had this bleach blonde hair. She was like a regular real life bad girl.
Okay.
And then my boyfriend at the time played drums. He was 2 years older than me, and he was in a band. And I remember one time his band were playing at this pub called Joseph's Well. I know, it was the Duchess. It was the Duchess. And that was famous to us because Nirvana had played there. So we're like, the Duchess. And that was, in those days, you could go to a pub, even though you were underage, as long as you didn't drink, you could be there. So you could be there at sort of 16, 17, as long as you didn't go anywhere near the bar. And he called me and he said, our support act is not, can't do our show next week. Do you guys want to play? Mm-hmm. And we were like, you know, we've got 3 songs. We have to get together and write, you know, 3 more songs so we can be the support band. But I just loved it. And I remember being on stage. I love the transition of, like, you write the songs in your bedroom, you practice in someone's living room, you take the equipment with you on the bus, you walk into the pub. You know, for us, it was like 3 girls, and we're all kind of like petite with our instruments. So we just went, who are these guys? And then, but then you get on stage,
mm-hmm.
and then the music was, you know, as distorted guitars, and I loved fact that people weren't expecting it of us, that's one thing I loved. But I also really loved just being there and thinking, oh, you know, I had this idea in my room and now here I am playing it on stage. And, you know, when you first do shows like that, it's your parents and your friends' parents and everyone's saying, oh, that was lovely. And then, but I remember the first time we did a gig where a person I didn't know came up to me and they were like, oh, that was there. And I thought, like, whose dad is this? But it was no one's dad. It was just a guy. Mm-hmm. And I really liked when you would play in a pub and people would be drinking at the bar and then they'd just like look over and then one by one, you know, they would come into the room and then by the end there'd be more people there than it started. And I just really liked the feeling of it, the excitement, the fear of it. And so I just carried on. And yeah, we really wanted to make it. We had a deal offered from Roadrunner Records, who were a metal label, but we were going to be the first indie signing. And the manager that we had at a time ended up in prison because he was kind of like a dodgy tax guy. And he was the son of a very, very well-known music manager. But anyway, he took us out for lunch to a fancy hotel. You know, we hadn't eaten places like that. We're like, he paid for the dinner. And it was all going really well. But our bass player, who was the cool girl in the band, she got pregnant. And I remember telling him, I was like, you know, Joanne's pregnant, but that's great, right? Because we'll be able to be on stage. She'll have a bump. And a big ass really cool. And then so I remember the next time we tried to call the phone, he didn't answer the phone. And then the next time we tried to call, he didn't answer the phone. Then the next time we tried to call, this is before email or anything, you know, so you've got a phone.
Your manager ghosted you?
Yeah, that was the end. I never saw him again.
Oh, he's crying now. And he,
yeah, well, yeah. I saw that he was like literally went to prison.
He's in prison. He's fine.
Oh, but, my bad. I forgot that part.
He's in prison. You don't know.
Yeah, but that's not why he didn't answer the phone. I think he just, the idea of like a pregnant teen bass player wasn't as cool as it was to us.
Right.
But then I had to go back to university. I was in my second year and I had to go into the third year kind of like tail between my legs. I'd been like, yes, yeah, you know, we're on our way, you know. I had to come back and pick up all the bits of literature that no one wanted to do, you know, medieval literature. But I finished my course and then I waitressed. And then I worked on the jewellery counter at this fancy department store, just kind of waiting to see what might happen with my band. And in the meantime, we got another manager and he was like, you know, you're writing all the songs, you are standing out. Why don't you come to London and write some songs with these different people and just sort of see what happens? And I felt really divided because it was all my best friends, you know, at the time. But my best friend who had a baby, she'd left and we had a different person. Then the drummer had left. We got a different drummer. So it wasn't really the same band.
It wasn't the same anymore.
And I just thought, yeah, I'm going to try this. I'm going to try this. And those songs became the songs that I had for my first record.
All right, y'all. You know what season it is. 'Tis the season for spring breaking and planning our summer travel. And if you're like me, you're already in your Airbnb app trying to find which spot is right for you. Now, listen, while I'm looking to spend all this money, what I'm not doing is thinking about making money with Airbnb. See, you got to change your mind state. Make the money while you're spending the money. How, you say, Laia, do I make the money? Well, you host at your house. And I know what you're thinking. I mean, my whole house? No, you don't have to do your whole house. I mean, you could do a room or, you know, do the whole house. So make some money while you're spending some money this summer. I'm trying to tell you, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
In the 1980s, Frank Farian was riding high as a successful German music producer, but he was bored.
German pop was formulaic, dull, and oh so white. Frank had bigger dreams, American dreams. He wanted to create the kind of music that would rival larger-than-life artists like Michael Jackson or Run DMC.
So he assembled a hip-hop duo, two once-in-a-lifetime talents who were charismatic, full of sex appeal, and phenomenal dancers. The only problem? One very important element was missing, but Frank knew just how to fix that.
Wondery's new podcast, Blame It on the Fame, dives into one of pop music's biggest controversies. Milli Vanilli set the world on fire, but when their adoring fans learned about the infamous lip syncing, their downfall was swift and brutal. With exclusive interviews from frontman Fab Morvan and his producers Frank Farian and Ingrid Segee, this podcast takes a fresh look at the exploitation of two young Black artists.
Follow Blame It on the Fame wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Blame It on the Fame early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus.
Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
So what was that first year like to just come out the box and instantly... I almost feel like it's harder to top the charts in the UK than it is America. Like, I know for everyone, making it in America is the dream, but I'm way more impressed because I feel like the hurdles are harder and higher to even make some sort of dent or impression in the UK. Because I almost feel like if you're hitting the UK, you can work forever because they're not as disposable as we are in the States. Like, I know right now, like, who's old boy with one eye, Fonte?
Old boy with one eye.
With one eye. Yeah. Like, okay. You remember when Fetty Wap was supposed to be the second coming of something? And yeah. I just found out he's in jail. Like, I didn't even know.
Yeah. Yeah, he had the two records. He had the Trap Queen and he had one of the
two. I mean, he had a moment in which I felt like he was going to be a thing, at least a second or a third album, a fourth, you know what I mean, that sort of thing. But to me, like, your album top the charts in the UK. What was that feeling like for you?
It was such a surprise. I remember getting a phone call. I was in Switzerland because I guess Europe's so small, right? So you do your bit of promotion in the UK, then you go to France, then you go to Italy, then you go to Spain, then you go to Germany, then you go to Holland, and you can do all that in about 2 weeks because it's mm-hmm. so small. And so I remember being in Switzerland and I got a phone call and they said, like, the album's gone to number one, and I just was like, what? You know, I just, because I still didn't know anybody knew about me, and it was mm-hmm. of course in the days when you had to physically go to a record shop and buy a record,
right?
So I just was like, how has this happened? And but I had got a lot of support from the BBC really early on. So in 2005 I had put out Like a Star as a just an EP. It was like a limited edition EP, but the BBC had kind of picked up on it and they'd put me on this TV show. It was called Later with Jules Holland.
Oh yeah.
And I remember
we just played with Jules last week.
So good. We just did one a few weeks ago, but I mean, he's such a big supporter of music, and it's a fully live show. It's five or six bands in a round, you know, and you just watch everyone do their thing. You all get one or two goes at it. Mm-hmm. I remember I was doing the showcase in London, and maybe the first Thursday 100 people came, and then the second Thursday like 200 people came, and the third Thursday like people couldn't get in, and then the fourth Thursday I'd done Jules Holland like earlier on in the day before I went to it, so it felt like it'd really gone from nobody knows about me to like, oh, I just got to play on the first ever TV show, you know. I remember once getting into a hotel room and I put on the radio through the TV and Like a Star was playing, and I was looking at it thinking, is my CD player plugged in mm-hmm. to here? And then I realized it's on the radio, the actual radio, someone else right. is playing it. So it was just new to me. And then everything was so fast, like, oh, Stevie Wonder's on the phone. What? Like, oh, we're playing a show in America. Oh, Prince has come to the show. Like, you've just met Mary J. Blige and she has heard of you, you know. It's just like, oh, I went to read out the nominations at the Grammys and I thought, this is amazing, I'm getting to read out the nominations. And then Justin Timberlake was saying, you know, song of the record of the year, and put your records on. I was like, what, you know? Yeah. This is the nomination. To me, the nominations were the Grammys. Like, it was mm-hmm. that was the biggest excitement for me, is just like hearing my name read out in a few categories, you know. So yeah, it was.
Answer one question for me. I don't want to interrupt you, but since you mentioned that, I gotta ask. So since you were on the Joni Letters, do you receive an actual Grammy?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, so I get it. Yeah. See, there's so much goalpost moving when it comes to who can get one, who can't get one.
Yeah.
Because I'm associated with a few records that are albums of the year, but I find out, like, in some categories, like, especially with hip-hop and soul, because there's so many collaborators and sample credits and all that stuff.
They don't want to make those trophies.
Yeah, they'll just give you a little certificate.
Yeah.
Saying you participated, but then I'll notice, like, on in classical and country and
pop,
in the main categories, like, everyone gets, like, you're an official Grammy winner, where mine is sort of like I get a trophy award, like, yeah, I participate in voodoo, here's my thing, you know.
Yeah, no,
so I always wanted to know.
Well, you should redress that,
man. I got my own other battles to deal with, so. No, but I do feel like when artists win album of the year in their respective categories, like, we too should get awards as well. So
yeah.
But I always wanted to know, in the main category, do you get an award or do you not get an award? Okay.
Yeah. See, yeah. I remember Herbie saying, if we win, I want you to come up on stage. But in the moment, I didn't go up. I just thought, like, I've contributed one song to this. This is Herbie's thing, and he had a lot to say, right? He had a speech prepared in his pocket, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
No,
so,
don't dismiss that. That was your moment.
Oh,
you know.
Thank you.
Just in wrapping up, for me, like, I feel like this album is the soundtrack to a movie that doesn't exist yet. Or like, how do you take this further? Because I feel like there's no turning, like, you've done open a door that can't be closed now. So, like, What is your next plan musically, at least?
That's a really good question. I mean, definitely my engagement with that building and those histories definitely doesn't stop. You know, I really want to write an essay about the erasure of Black childhood that I saw in the objects in the Arts Bank, because it's a kind of strategic, you know, wide ranging kind of assault on childhood, you know, mm-hmm. hundreds of years long, but you know, it's 200 years of evidence in the Arts Bank in terms of Black children being depicted as not fully innocent. They're sexualized, they're seen as labor, you know, people who labor. It's like Black childhood doesn't exist for the Black children in the objects in the Ed Williams collection. Mm-hmm. And then right next to the Arts Bank is the Tamir Rice Pavilion, which is going to be torn down. And Tamir Rice's mother came to Theaster and asked whether that could have its place next to the bank, so that Tamir Rice Pavilion is there. And, you know, I think a lot about the connection between what is it for a police officer to not perceive someone as a child, to think of them as a dangerous adult instead of seeing them as a child playing with a toy, because they've been swimming in this culture, lifelong culture that extends back generations, of not affording Black children the same space, innocence, joy, freedom as other children. You know, how does it, one thing is cartoons and stories and silly picture books and, you know, illustrations in the Black Sambo and postcards saying, oh, all these coons look alike. But the real world effect is, you know, it's death for some young people.
Mm-hmm.
And so I definitely want to make some sort of, I want to do some sort of work around that. But at the same time, I know there's people who are more gifted in that area. You know, I'm just reading Christina Sharp's book. You know, there's some towering academics in that world. But at the same time, there's all this collection of the stuff that I'm interested in. So yeah, I mean, I need one to find a way to make some sort of commentary in that. But yeah, for me musically, I just feel like I came from a place on my third album feeling like I am a failed pop star who has sort of squandered their chips at the, you know, the roulette table of music, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, you had all this and you could have, and my third record was that, you know, it was me just playing what songs to music executives, you know, eight men in a room, and having them say, oh, I just don't think that's the first single, you know, and mm-hmm. thinking, okay. And after a while, I didn't need them to be in the room at all, because they were just in my head. Everything mm-hmm. I started, I thought, what's the point of even finishing this song? It's not an international mega smash, you know, it's not Uptown Funk So why am I even going to finish it? To now feeling like I am an artist. An artist's job is to exemplify freedom. This is my work. This is what I love to do. It's what I've always loved to do. This is what I'll always do. That is the position I feel like I'm in now.
Are you pleased with the response that you're getting about the record?
I'm overjoyed with the response, definitely, because I feel, I mean, I don't read it, but I've got someone who's telling me, you know, it's a good response. And
I live between fuck Pitchfork and, did you see what Pitchfork said? And to me, you know, sometimes they get it right. I mean, even when they're dissing me, they get it right. But sometimes they get it right.
Yeah. What's been the difference? We were talking about labels earlier. Now that you're with 30 Tigers and kind of doing it independently, what is that like now? What is the difference between, you know, being
I love labels. Able to sit them?
Yeah.
Put a number before an animal. So,
right.
Yeah. Here's a good 16 gorilla records. Dr. Seuss, I think. But yeah, I loved that label straight away when I met them. I mean, I made the record independently. I made it with my own means, and I made it with, you know, from our studio. And that gave me all this freedom. One, I thought of it as a side project. Two, there was no one saying, where's the hits or when is it finished? Which was really important because I also realized I don't respond well to that kind of pressure either. And my first record had sort of been made like that. I made it in the basement of an art studio with someone that I got to know as a friend, you know? So, and then we walked it into labels and we walked it to Sony and they were like, and then we walked it to Universal and they were, you know, so it's like, I felt, and I feel like whatever I do in the future, I'm going to make that record and see who likes it, because why would you want to work with people who don't like it? And it's so hard, you know, my third record, it was so hard feeling like I was just disappointing people at every turn, you know, and at that point, people are getting sacked if you don't make the right record, right?
And
people are losing their jobs. And the people you've known for 10 years and you know their kids. And so you feel a lot of responsibility, but it's so weird being an artist, how you can feel trapped by the things that you made, you know, that it doesn't make any sense, does it? But I think you can make something and then it makes you this corridor. And then you think, well, that I have to go down that, you know, the way that I was able to feel free on this was thinking it's not a Corinne Bailey Ray record, but that's just me. So, you know, it was only when the artist, you know, he's a brilliant graph writer. He writes and makes amazing things for Skateboard. The Skateboard magazine is where I saw his work.
Okay.
It's only when he sent me the cover and I saw my name, the first thing I thought was like, I forgot to tell him not to put my name on it. It's meant to say Black Rainbows.
Right.
And then I saw my name, I thought, there's something about not seeing it as a font. I think sometimes when you see your name as a font, it becomes a sort of brand that somehow like tears away from you and becomes a separate thing. And it's like, oh, it's not in that font. It's just freehand, but it's me. And I thought, yeah, I never want to be boxed in again by my perception of what I think other people's perception of me, which of course is too circular anyway. So yeah, I definitely sort of can't go back. And then now I'm just trying to work out what to do next.
Tour wise, how many weeks are you doing in the States? And
we did 5 weeks in September. Then we went to Europe and did 6 weeks. Oh no, it wasn't 6 weeks. It was about four. And then we've come back now and we've done some West Coast dates. And then we've got our Blue Note shows. And then we're coming back in June and doing some US dates as well. And I'm playing in Australia and I'm playing, you know, it's like it's, that's a good thing. It's, you know, just getting to play all over the world. It's a dream to me, you know. It's, I'm not playing to 20,000 people, I'm playing to 2,000 people, but they're scattered all over the world and I'm happy to get on a plane and go to them, you know.
One last question I wanted to ask, Corinne, I was always curious about your recording process for The Sea. You mentioned earlier that, you know, that was when your husband had died, and so from what I've read, part of it was recorded prior and then the other half was recorded after. How did you make it through that process?
It happened. I think it happened when we were recording Black Lily.
That's right. We had done some work.
We did a take.
And then, yeah, and I had done this great jam with James Poyser. And it was like, oh, this feels really good. And I'm happy in this really happy place. And Jason was playing with Mark Ronson. And it was just, things were looking so good for us. And then you know,
we took a dinner break, and then I just remember the session stopped. And at first I was like, well, I guess he didn't like where we were going with it. I had no clue. And then they explained to me what happened.
I can't remember. I think something might have happened while we were there. But then, yeah, this all happened in the March in 2008. And then I guess after that, I just sort of stopped making music. It kind of felt like the end of my life. And I was 29. And, you know, when you're 29, you sort of think you're old, you know, because you're nearly 30, and 30 is the end of your life, right? So I thought, well, you know, I've had this great life, and I've done this, I've had all this great, you know, I've really enjoyed my music stuff. That when you have an intense period, sometimes that 18 months feels more expansive than it really is. So it felt like I've done a few years of this. And then, yeah, I just thought, okay, that's the end of my life. And then it was so painful, I kind of couldn't imagine 39, 49, 59, 60. I just thought, how could I sort of carry on with this amount of physical pain? And then I guess, you know, anyone who's experienced grief, it's just like slowly, slowly, slowly. It's like the sound being sort of turned back up again, and you find little moments, or you find interest, or you see. I remember being in New York and seeing this couple, and she was pregnant and they had a little baby. And I remember sort of thinking, oh, like I had a little pine for that. Like, oh, in my future, I want to be a parent. I remember feeling that. And that was a little sort of crack of hope. And then, you know, or I'd sit at the piano and just get like two chords. I think, oh, I want to finish that. So there were just little bits of things. But it's a really, 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 really long time. You know, and when I was touring the sea, I was still very much in my sort of widowhood. And so, I mean, it was useful to play the songs, but it was really difficult to play them as well. And also, it attracted to me a lot of people who were grieving too, which was very beautiful, but also had its own weight to it. You know, I remember meeting a couple after a show, and they talked, they had lost a child before it was born, and they wanted to talk to me about that. And they even wanted to show me photographs. And I remember sort of thinking, I am not sort of qualified for
this. Right. This is far beyond my pay grade, dog.
Yeah, but at the same time, here I am in this space, which is I'm standing on a stage talking about loss, and not many people are saying that at this moment. And so it was just, I'd meet people in the street, they say, I lost my brother, I lost my mother, I lost my partner. People would write me letters, I lost my husband. And I felt in my heart was so open and bleeding in that time, you know, just like the naivety that you can have if you haven't experienced loss. You sort of walk around the world like, yeah, I'm kind of in control of my life. And, you know, and like, I just got to manifest this. And you just don't realize like how everything can change in a moment. So I guess when I came through that grief, the place I arrived at was total gratitude at being alive. And, you know, and then I had my children, and then I felt very differently about my life. I thought, I really want to live, you know, I want to make it, you know, I want to make it, I want to survive for them. So every day that I wake up, I'm like an old person, you know, when you talk to an 80-year-old and you say, how are you? And they say, well, I woke up today. You know, they say that. It's like, that's what I'm like. I'm like, here I am. I'm awake. You know, I'm here. Like, I just feel this massive gratitude and massive joy all the time, because I've been so low to the point where I felt I don't want this life. I don't want my life. And now I really, really want it. Really want it. So I'm really grateful. And definitely playing music helped me to articulate those thoughts.
Well, I thank you for sharing that. And again, I fucking love your album. And I, you know, anyone listening now, just please, like, give your support. Like, this is really, really a great record. And repeat listens over and over again. And, you know, I can't wait to see this live. I'm going to see you this week when you come to Blue Note. Of course, this will be on the air way after the fact. So if Corinne is in town, then you need to support her. But thank you for doing this for us, and I appreciate you taking the time.
Thanks for making space. For having us. I really appreciate it. Thanks, everybody.
For sure.
This is Questlove, and thank you once again, Ms. Ray, for joining us. And we'll see you guys on the next go round of Questlove Supreme. All right.
First Love Supreme is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
The following is a high-five moment from HighFiveCasino.com.
Welcome to Burger Yippee. Would you like a hot apple pie today?
Yes, yes, yeah, I won! Woohoo!
So that's a yes on the apple pie?
I just went big time playing High Five Casino on my phone. Real cash prizes, free daily rewards, over 1,200 games. Yeah!
So yes or no on the apple pie?
Woo! I won again!
I'll take that as a yes. Drive around.
Have you had your high-five moment today? Only at HighFiveCasino.com.
High Five Casino is a social casino. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Conditions apply. See website for details.
High Five Casino.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.